You're listening to NPR on Health, a weekly roundup of the best health and healthcare stories filed by NPR correspondents around the world. I'm your host, Joe Neal. This week, we'll hear about a study that challenges the age-old advice to drink 8 glasses of water a day. Also, emailing your doctor. Not many doctors give out their email address, but that may be changing. And finally, a few short updates on issues in the news. When we get together around here every week to look at the medical journals, one or two papers usually jump out. This week, it was an editorial in the Journal of the American Nephrology Society. It presented evidence that not only should you not drink 8 glasses of water every day, it said it might even be harmful. But one editorial is not the last word on any subject. So we asked NPR's Allison Aubrey to look at the general hype that's out there surrounding hydration.
It's not that everyone follows the recommendation to drink 8 glasses of water a day, but a lot of people seem to think it's a good idea. I spoke to a bunch of commuters who ride the train into Washington each day.
Well, I guess it's an essential, yes.
I don't see that it can hurt you.
And I see you've got your water right here tucked into your knapsack.
Absolutely. I think it's good for the skin and for your system.
Tracy Hummer's getting at a common assumption here. It's that all this water helps to clear the gunk or toxins from our bodies. That's an appealing concept, says physician Stanley Goldfarb, a kidney expert at the University of Pennsylvania. He explains that the kidneys do filter toxins from the bloodstream and clear them out of the body.
So the question is, does drinking more water increase this normal, important function of the kidneys? And the answer is no. In fact, drinking large amounts of water actually, and surprisingly, tends to reduce the kidney's ability to function as a filter. It's a subtle decline, but definite.
Goldfarb says it's not exactly clear why this happens. The going theory is that drinking lots of water may stimulate a part of the nervous system, and this appears to slightly constrict the blood vessels that lead to the kidneys.
That probably is the mechanism of this slight fall.
Goldfarb explains if you take a 200-pound man, a full 120 pounds of his body is already water. So could drinking a few extra glasses each day on top of what's consumed in food or other beverages really have measurable effects, say, on the quality of your skin?
In reality, it's such a tiny part of the amount of water that's in the body that it's very, very unlikely that one is getting any benefit from that.
So for everyone in the habit of hauling around their Nalgene bottles or buying loads of bottled water, is it worth all the fuss? University of Pittsburgh's Madeline Fernstrom says it may be, particularly if you're trying to lose weight.
Water's a great strategy for dieters because it has no calories, so you can keep your mouth busy without food and get the sense of satisfaction.
Fernstrom says, as for the amount, there's nothing special about drinking 8 glasses, nor is there anything magical about water alone. She says other zero-calorie options, such as diet sodas, are fine too. Dr. Stanley Goldfarb is not sold on the diet argument. He points out that researchers who've studied this have come up with conflicting results.
There were some studies that suggested that, in fact, caloric intake was reduced when individuals were given water prior to eating. Other studies suggested that it wasn't.
So on this issue, you may be the best judge of whether drinking more helps you eat less. As for people just hoping to feel better, some may take Bill Salvatore's approach. He's one of the commuters we heard from earlier who says drinking a little extra water can't hurt you.
It's just going to make you go to the bathroom a lot more, that's all.
Goldfarb agrees. He says a few people may benefit from extra fluids, for example, those with kidney stones. And certainly athletes and hikers know it's important to avoid dehydration. But for the most part, Goldfarb says, people shouldn't worry about how much water they've had to drink each day. His advice? Just drink when you're thirsty. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
How many times have you played phone tag with your doctor or hung up on a friend because you didn't want to miss the doctor's call? Hopefully, those days may soon be over. More and more, doctors are going online to communicate with their patients. Doctors have been reluctant to use email, in part because they don't get paid for it. But this year, the nation's biggest health insurers, Aetna and Cigna, started reimbursing doctors for a service that provides secured web visits. From San Francisco, Deirdre Kennedy reports.
At his office near downtown Oakland, internist Dr. Dean Nichols checks secured online messages from his patients throughout the day.
So this is a patient who had a recent diagnosis of a relatively rare condition called polymyalgia rheumatica and is being treated with steroids and had some questions regarding the management of this problem.
In the past, finding a patient's chart, reading through it, and then reaching the patient by phone might have taken days. Not anymore. Nichols gets messages through a secure portal from a wide variety of people, homebound elders, students away at school, and workers with busy schedules. It's changed the way he manages his patient load.
Rather than being interrupted while I'm seeing a patient, I can handle my email messages from patients either before office hours, after office hours, over the noon hour. So it really actually frees me up to spend more time with patients.
By logging into a secure web-based service called Relay Health, Dr. Nichols' patients can request an appointment, ask for a referral, or get a prescription refill. Or they can sign up for what's called a web visit. Retired oncologist Joseph Halperin and his wife Lynn are both patients of Dr. Nichols. They often sign on for web visits to get feedback on minor conditions.
For example, my wife had the flu. She coughed quite a bit, then developed a pain that she thought was either a crack rib or a muscle strain. And we didn't think it required a visit because we didn't think there could be anything done about that kind of condition, but just wanted some reassurance about that.
So what did Dr. Nichols end up telling you?
He said it's probably a strain and it should go away within a week to 10 days, which it did.
Email between physicians and patients is nothing new, but concerns over privacy issues, getting unedited ramblings from patients, and lack of reimbursement made many doctors reluctant to e-chat. Now major health plans are paying for the online visits through Relay Health, and the company's secure portal serves as an electronic advice nurse that helps focus the online inquiry to the doc, Relay's general manager Ken Tarkoff.
It's an online interview with branching logic based on a variety of questions that the system asks the patient to provide answers to, and based on those answers, it provides additional questions.
Questions such as, how long have you been experiencing this symptom? Do you have a fever? Have you taken any medication? How is it working? Questions designed by a team of physician advisors. The online communication then becomes part of the patient's record. This year, health insurers Aetna and Cigna started aggressively marketing the service to more than 1 million physicians across the country. Cigna spokesman Joe Mondi says e-visits benefit physicians, employers, and patients because it only costs $25.
There's a substantial savings there. In addition to that cost savings, there's also, of course, the time saving, which is a value to really all three of them.
But not all physicians have confidence in the technology. Cardiologist Jim Rohack is on the board of the American Medical Association. He's concerned about the security of online communication.
Once you put things in cyberspace, they can go all over the place. At least with a telephone, you know, even with a cell phone, you pretty much it's a one-on-one conversation.
And he says there are times when online communication between doctor and patient is not appropriate.
Any time where a physical examination has to be done to make a diagnosis, the person's having chest pain, for example, it's very difficult to make the determination over email whether or not the person's having a heart attack or not.
But Tarkoff of Relay Health is confident that patients and physicians are capable of making that judgment call.
It's not right for every situation. It's an additional thing that you can offer to patients where it's appropriate for patients who understand how to use it effectively and where the physicians are comfortable that those patients can provide the information over the web.
Patients are always advised to seek urgent care if they have symptoms like chest pain, a high fever, or uncontrolled bleeding. Americans do seem to be eager to adopt the technology. A recent Harris Interactive survey of online users found that 74% of patients would like to be able to communicate with their doctors through some sort of email. For NPR News, I'm Deirdre Kennedy in San Francisco.
And now for some updates. First, there's news about nicotine's addictive power. It may be more genetic than once thought. Scientists have found a region on chromosome 15 associated with the development of lung cancer. The studies may help to explain why some smokers get lung cancer and others don't. NPR's Joe Palca explains.
There's a new genetic technique that allows you to search through chromosomes looking for places that might be involved in diseases. Teams from Texas, France, and Iceland use this technique to look for genetic regions that might play a role in the development of lung cancer. All three found the same region of chromosome 15, and all three found that inheriting a particular version of this region could increase lung cancer risk by as much as 80%. The groups differed on whether the genetic region was enough to increase risk by itself or whether it was only a risk for people who smoked. The genes in this region appear to play a role in the way nicotine alters cells. The work appears in the current issue of the journals Nature and Nature Genetics. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Lawmakers on Capitol Hill are another step closer to regulating tobacco. Here's NPR's Julie Rovner.
After literally decades of debate, this could be the year the FDA gets the authority to regulate the sale, marketing, and manufacture of tobacco products. The bill, approved by a House committee by a vote of 38-12, would not allow the agency to ban tobacco, but it could put limits on the use of nicotine, which is what makes tobacco addictive. Bill opponents, like Texas Republican Joe Barton, said they were concerned that the FDA has trouble handling its current duties.
This legislation, if it becomes law, would require the FDA to take on a task that's enormous, complex, and completely outside of its regulatory experience.
But the measure appears to have majority support in both the House and Senate, where a committee approved a similar bill last fall. Floor action is expected in both chambers later this spring. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
For more health coverage, tune into your local NPR station. You can find a list of them at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, look for more health stories by clicking on Health and Science. Joe Neal, NPR News.